but yeah, sit down for a minute and just like cry for 5 minutes. Like, give yourself a break for 5 minutes. Give yourself a judgment-free zone for 5 minutes. Start working on your book proposal for 5 minutes. Look at sites about how to, you know, sell everything and travel the world for 5 minutes. Work on your marriage for 5 minutes. I, you know, whatever it is for you, you know what it is. I tend to think that people go, when they go, well, I don't really know what I want. Yeah, you do. Like, deep down, yeah, you do. You do. You do. Come on. Truth, truth, truth. You know. It's just super scary. So like 5 minutes of being gentle with yourself, because there's this super scary thing that you know you haven't done that you really want to do. Like 5 minutes.
That was Kate Swoboda, and you're listening to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette, episode 132. Welcome to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette. That's me. The podcast that's filled with refreshingly honest conversations about the wonderful mess of being human. I'm super thrilled that you're listening in today. And I want to take a minute right here at the top to share some gratitude and then to share an exciting update. So first, seriously, thanks for listening to this show. Thanks for valuing honest conversations. Thanks for being open to hearing from guests whose lived experiences and opinions might be different from your own. That's hugely important. And thanks for the more tangible stuff as well, for taking a minute or two to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening from. That's such a huge help in spreading the word and in helping new people find us. So thank you so much for doing that. The show currently has 233 ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts, and I would love to get to 500 by the end of the year. So thank you for helping with that if you have a minute to jump on and leave a rating or review. And more than anything, thanks so much for supporting and funding this show on Patreon. Together, we've built a truly community-funded podcast with no ads or corporate sponsorship, which means that we have complete freedom to come together with more honesty than ever before, which I'm really excited about. So in a few minutes, I'm going to introduce you to today's wonderful guest. But first, in case you're new to this show, I'd love to just quickly explain what we do here. At the heart of it, my guests and I are committed to one simple but powerful thing: telling the truth about our lives. No one's here to sell you anything. No one's trying to get you to fix yourself or your life. I certainly don't have any magic answers, and I can't give you a miraculous 10-day, 6-step life hack plan for anything. Sorry, not sorry. But as a recovering self-help junkie myself, honestly, I'm so over that approach, and my guess is that maybe you are too. Perhaps that's why you're here. So no, that's not what this show's about. Here at Real Talk Radio, I sit down with athletes, writers, entrepreneurs, parents, coaches, adventurers, artists, activists, and many others, and we dive deep into meaningful topics. We talk about work, love, money, sex, addiction, friendship, racism, body image, mental health, grief, fear, courage, change, and everything in between. This is definitely an adult podcast covering adult subjects, which means that we often use adult language, so fair warning on that. But we never shy away from telling the unfiltered truth in an open and honest way, even when that's uncomfortable. So with this mission in mind, like I said, you won't hear any ads or sponsor promotions. These honest conversations are 100% listener-funded, made possible by awesome regular people like you who give $8 or more per 8-episode season. The show is and will always be free, but if you love it, if these conversations make you laugh, think, or just feel less alone, I hope that you'll go to patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette to make your pledge of $8 or more per 8-episode season. And now for that quick update that I said that I'm excited to share. Over on Patreon, you'll see our current funding goal. And when we reach that goal, it means that every single person who works on this show will get paid. That includes me and my sound engineer, Adam Day, as well as every single guest who comes onto the show. Because that's my vision, for each of our guests to be paid for the time, energy, honesty, care, and emotional labor that they bring to these conversations. The budget won't be huge to start with, and it'll hopefully continue to grow over time as the community grows and obviously then the funding grows with it. But higher rates will always be paid to our guests of color, as well as our queer and trans guests and others with traditionally marginalized identities who are generously spending a few hours of their time with me, a white straight cis woman, to share their lives and stories with our majority white audience. Being able to pay all of our guests has been a dream of mine for a while now, because as you've probably heard me say before, I fully believe that where we spend our money is a real-time vote for the kind of world we want to live in. And if I want to live in a world where people get paid for the work that they do, especially creative work, that means that it's up to me to create that model here at Real Talk Radio, even if it's definitely not the norm in the podcast industry. And believe me, it's not. So just know that when you help to fund this show, you're using your money as a vote for a world of honest, judgment-free conversations. You're voting to hear more stories from a wide-ranging group of people, the vast majority of whom are women, and you're voting to pay those folks for the entertainment and education that they so expertly provide. When you support this show, you're saying loudly and proudly that women's voices deserve to be heard, and that no topic should be off limits due to fear or shame. It's a show by truth tellers for truth tellers, and as a thank you for supporting, you'll get access to over 40 hours of bonus content, as well as our monthly book club, my weekly behind-the-scenes email series where I share my real life in real time. Oh man, if you think it gets vulnerable and honest on the podcast, just wait until you start getting my emails. Plus, you'll be the first to know when tickets go on sale for Real Talk Live events and retreats. Also, 5% of each season's profits are donated to social justice organizations, a different organization each season. Past organizations include Black Lives Matter and the Venture Out Project, so you can feel awesome about that aspect of your contribution as well. When you head over to Patreon, you'll see that there are currently three different funding levels that you can choose from: an $8 level, a $16 level, and a $25 level, each with their own unique, awesome bonuses. At the $25 level, we even do live Google Hangouts together, and oh my gosh, those are so much fun. So one more time, that's patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette. And at the very end of this episode, you'll actually get to meet one of our Patreon community members who joins me for a fun little rapid-fire question round. So stick around for that after the main episode for sure. And now let's dive right into today's episode. Today, you'll get to meet Kate Swoboda, aka Kate Courageous. Kate is a triathlete, the creator of yourcourageouslife.com, director of the Courageous Living Coach Certification, and author of The Courage Habit, How to Accept Your Fears, Release the Past, and Live Your Courageous Life. She helps individuals, teams, and companies see where old fear-based habits have limited what's possible so that they can start creating more courageous lives by getting into The Courage Habit, a four-part process for behavioral and organizational change. Kate has appeared in MindBody Green, Entrepreneur, USA Today, Forbes, Business Insider, and so many others, and her website was named a top 50 blog for happiness by Greatest. She's spoken at conferences and seminars on the topic of courage as it relates to personal development, releasing overwhelm, business and marketing, money mindset, wellness, increasing emotional resilience, and healthy goal setting using habit formation techniques. In this episode, Kate breaks down the ways in which courage is actually a habit that can be built and strengthened, and she shares tons of personal, vulnerable examples from her own life and business. We talk about the different manifestations of fear that she's experienced in various areas of her life, as a triathlete, as an entrepreneur, and as a mom, and she talks honestly about everything from perfectionism and time management to the ways in which she's defined success for herself. I so loved this conversation with Kate, and I hope that you do too. So all of that starts in just a moment, and as always, you'll be able to find all the links and resources mentioned in this episode over in the show notes at NicoleAntoinette.com/podcast. Awesome. We are good to go. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have been really, 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 really looking forward to this. I feel like there's my only point of stress is that there's too many things that I want to talk to you about. And I'm like, okay, it's going to be fine. Just like calm down. The 2 hours is going to be enough.
I'll come back if there's a need for more. It'll be totally great.
I had a moment in the couple hours that I was prepping for this where I was like, wait, but what do you want to talk to her about most? And I was like, it's going to be fine. Like, this is a really good problem to have. So since we are not on video, as we discussed prior to recording, that we don't even really like talking on Skype video, set the scene. Where are you sitting? What are you drinking? Where in the world are you? Describe that for me.
Okay. So I'm in Petaluma, California. I am sitting in my office. I have a home office, which is, I have a fascination with or a love of white on white designs. So like different like creams and bone whites and, you know, slight off whites, like kind of all layered together. So like my desk is white. I have a white couch. I have white curtains, white walls. And the only thing that isn't white is this kind of pop of color, you know, painting that's on my wall. That's my jam. And I jokingly call it, when we give house tours to new people we've met who are like, show me around the house, I'll jokingly say, welcome to the sanitarium. And it's just, oh, I love my office. It's cozy. It's just, it's my incubator of ideas. And let's see, I've got water. I've got coffee in a mug that says "You Rock." And I'm sitting here. I'm wearing a t-shirt. I voted today in my local California primaries. And I'm wearing my Garmin. I got a fancy new Garmin Forerunner 235, which for me is fancy because it's like the most tech I've ever had on my wrist, and it's very exciting. And my resting heart rate is 59.
That's an amazing set of details. It's funny that you mentioned the home office and described it. First of all, I definitely want pictures of your office. But this, like at the time of this recording, I just put a story up on Instagram this morning that was sort of like a tiny little mini tour of my home office. I've been finding recently that I am really interested and curious about people's creative spaces, whatever that looks like, whether that's, you know, their desk in an office, whether it's a home office, whether it's the tiny corner of their studio apartment where they write, or, you know, whatever that looks like what the conditions are that make people feel calm and able to do their best work, and how that's so different person to person.
Oh yeah. Me too. I have that fascination as well. And speaking of that, like one thing that I think is pretty interesting about my office in terms of workflow is that I have my desktop computer, which is like work, email, all that stuff. And years ago, it felt very decadent to me. I bought, after years of wanting one and not letting myself have it, I bought a MacBook Air, and it is a laptop. It's got Wi-Fi access, but there's no email set up on it. There's no software on it other than the standard software that came preloaded with the computer. And that is my writing laptop. I needed like a separate area for my brain, and I love it. I love it.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I love hearing that stuff too, like how people have containers for their work. Like I'm talking to you right now through my MacBook Air, but that's my like one, everything happens on this little computer. The J key has fallen off, or like the button at least. So, I mean, luckily it's a letter that I don't use that much. You have to push like right directly in the center of it to have a J come out. But yeah, this is my be all end all laptop that everything happens on, and it's getting closer and closer to dying every day. And I'm like, I should probably back it up more often than I do.
Right.
So let's start with what I know is one of your favorite questions. If I really knew you, what would I know about you?
Oh, yes. Okay. So this question is one that I learned from Rich and Yvonne Dutra St. John of the Challenge Day organization. They're an organization that goes in and tries to stop bullying in schools. And this is one of the icebreakers they use to really open up a conversation that goes beyond the, you know, superficial. So if you really knew me, you'd know. If I really knew you, what would you know? Let's see here. The truest thing in this moment is that I am looking at taking some time off of work after getting the Courage Habit out into the world. And it drives me nuts. Like I ride a really thin line between loving my work and like being in it and being really, really good. And then because I'm passionate about my work, pushing too far, like little things start to pile up, like going, oh yeah, that would be a great idea. I'll do that too. And it feels good in the moment. And that's what gets tricky, because it feels good in the moment to say yes to that thing. And then later it's like, fuck, why did I say yes to that thing? I have too much going on. Or skipping a meal and then getting like really irritable. And so I just am really clear that I need to take like the summer off. I need to just dial it back. And I feel like this feels like a really big deal. And then I start doing this thing in my head where I'm really critical of myself. Like, God, can't, you're so privileged. You get to take a whole summer off and then you're complaining about it. Hey, you can't just relax and take it. And you know, that this voice in my head comes in that's just like having a field day. And then it's like, okay, I got to breathe with that. You know, it is what it is. And it just feels really, I don't know, like ego identity scary. And I'm aware of that. And I'm aware that it's just ego. I'm aware that it's just this identity that I have that's probably too aligned with my work. Mm-hmm. But it still feels really weird. And like I said, it's been driving me nuts. I have to keep not putting things on my to-do list. I have to keep going, oh, yo, wait, before I go on this vacation, I got to take care of this. And it's like, nope. Like that can wait 8 weeks.
Yeah. So this is something that you've planned for, to take the summer off this summer?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so it sounds like maybe you haven't taken that quantity of time off before from your business?
No.
All right. A whole new world.
No. Yeah. And that's part of the thing too, because it's the, there were years when I was developing my business where it's like, I mean, if we go with like the business being almost like a baby metaphor, like in the early years of business, it's like all hands on deck, you've got a newborn here. And I think that that's really real. And I think that, you know, like in the initial years of business, you're building something and you're building something that is dependent on you to be fed and watered and cleaned up and nurtured. And you got to teach it how to walk. And now I've been in business for myself for more than a decade. And I was having this whole conversation with my coach about wanting to take a summer off and feeling like maybe I the whole neuroses of it. And then I kind of arrived at this place in that session of going, you know what, if I have spent 10 years, more than that, 2009, I mean, I've been a coach since 2006. So I was part-time with my business then. So I went, 2009 is when I started going full-time with things. You know, if I can be in business this long and I have not yet earned the ability to like let things go for 8 weeks and this will stand on its own, then this is not actually a successful business. And mm-hmm. I actually need to like pack it in. And so once I put it in that frame, it was like, oh, okay, I'm going to be fine. Like I've got a team. They're awesome. I adore them. I trust them. We're good. Like we're good. Okay. I can pack it in for 8 weeks and I'll be fine.
Yeah, I think that point you're bringing up about the importance of essentially defining success for yourself, right? Which I know you didn't use that language exactly, but this idea of, okay, if I've been doing this for this long and I can't take an extended break or I haven't set up the systems in a way that support that, then that doesn't feel successful for you, right? And so like, no matter how much money it's making or no matter how long you've been doing it or how tied up your ego and identity is in it or how many people you've helped, it's like, wait, this actually isn't serving all of my needs. And being, I think that that looks different for different people and being able to say, okay, like a successful business for me or a successful, you know, relationship or whatever the thing is, and to actually give yourself permission to name what the specifics are. And like you said, maybe that's not going to happen right away, right? It's not, hey, 1 month into a business, I'm going to take 8 weeks off. Like that doesn't necessarily seem like that would work out. But, you know, with the constraints that are realistic, you know, with realistic expectations, being able to say, okay, like by X point, you know, I want this thing to be true. And if not, I really need to evaluate the what I'm doing here.
Yes. Yes. And I think that was like the thing that clicked in for my logic brain that was just going, but what about relevance online? And then you'd be like, well, you got buffer. It schedules everything. What mm-hmm. do you mean relevant? It's not like you're going dark for 8 weeks. Like there will still be a presence. And then it's like, well, what about like handling, you know, what if there, and like all these things about money and really the scarier thing is all about the significant stuff. And what if I miss a big opportunity and just really go and like, look, if it's truly a big opportunity, they like, okay. Yeah. If Oprah calls, of course I'm going to like go say hi to Oprah. All right. Like that's, you know, but like kind of anything else, like it can, if it's really a good opportunity, if it's really a match, like it can wait 8 weeks. And how do I give myself the space to just trust that and get out of that? It's a real scarcity mentality of like, I have to be there at all times just in case something is missed.
Yeah.
I don't like how that feels.
Yeah. I also think there's an interesting ego piece in that, you know, what you were talking about being like, again, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but what I'm taking from what you're saying is sort of this fear of being forgotten or not being relevant. And like mm-hmm. this, I don't know, like, I think there's something to be said for giving people time to miss you. I know you're not going totally dark, but I think we're afraid, like, if I don't churn out content constantly all the time, and yet some of the people that I look to whose work I love the most or who I consider to be the biggest inspirations, and they're not people who are just constantly posting things all the time. Like, that almost creates, like, a blind spot for me. If they're always posting, I almost tune it out, right? Where if it's, like, a little bit less often or whatever that looks like. So that's a good reminder. But I think that there's something really real and vulnerable about, you know, if I make this change or if I'm not here all the time, are people gonna forget? Or what does this say about how wrapped up is my identity and what I do for a living? Or it's interesting too for me at this time period to hear you talk about this because, I mean, when this episode comes out, I'll be what, like 2 weeks away from leaving for a 4 month hike of the PCT. And like that's a third of the year. And all this stuff's coming up too. Like I'm hitting really good momentum with the podcast, with my business and with my writing mm-hmm. and all these things. And I'm like, oh my God, this is a terrible time to take time off. What if all the questions that you just brought up, and sure, maybe that'll be true. And also maybe it'll be fine, you know?
Yep, I have the same fear. Because that's the thing, is the courage habit just came out. So it's very like, should I be riding this momentum? Should I da da da? And then it's like, again, you know, like how much trust am I putting in the value of the work? Like I'm wildly excited about what I've created. I worked for years to create this book. If it actually can stand on its own two feet as something that's valuable and that gives help and benefit to other people, then that's going to be happening in September. You know, like yeah. There's not. And I think too, that one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately, so I read this article, about, it was a Business Insider article, and it was like this person, from the millennials. I mean, I'm a little bit older than the millennials, but probably still technically within that. I was born in 1979. So, you know, technically on the like just edge of being considered a millennial. And this person was talking about like it was this big thing to like not be checking her phone and not have it beside her bed at bedtime. And I had this reaction to this article of just like, that's a self-created problem. Like, I mean, there are people who are born with like actual biochemical tendencies towards anxiety, but like cell phone addiction, there was this judgment I had about like, this is a self-created problem. You're the one picking up the phone and looking at the da 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 da. But then as I try to do when I get judgy judge, you know, as I try to go, okay, all right. But like, I don't like how I feel when I judge people. So how am I like this person? And then it was like, oh, well, you know, trying to be significant online. There mm-hmm, you go.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking that I can't put it away, thinking that I can't put it down, thinking that I can't, you know, and it's so silly, right? Like, because first of all, trying to be significant online, like it's this weird thing that I think most of us in the online sphere do around, you know, numbers and platform size and stuff like that. But in reality, if I'm hanging out with someone, if I'm talking to them, there's no part of me that wants to feel significant, because why would I want to feel significant compared to that person? Or like they are looking to me for what I'm going to say. That like, that's a hierarchical thing. Mm-hmm. Like it's not even what I want. And also I think we forget, like this all exists on a hard drive somewhere. Like we are making entire stories up about how we live based on a bunch of data that's sitting on a hard drive somewhere. It's real in a sense, but it's not really real, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Yeah. So being able to sort of like check how hooked into it you are emotionally, I think is always a relevant thing. I also think there's like, it's really easy to overinflate our own importance or overinflate. Like it sounds like, oh my gosh, you're going to take 8 weeks off. I mean, if you look at the course of a lifetime, 8 weeks is nothing. Right. And so nothing. It's like, and that's the same thing for me. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to be gone if all goes according to plan for a third of the year. And sure, like that's a long time. It's a long time to be away from my partner. It's not insignificant. And also, I mean, how many 4 month chunks of my life do I like not even really remember what happened? Right. And so it's like, if I think it's helpful for me to get some perspective on that. And also to remember, I mean, the importance of like walking the walk, so to speak, that like is doing this, what you're doing, you know, taking this time off, prioritizing family and pleasure and slowing down and whatever this break means to you, that's a courageous thing to do, right? So it's like, if you say that you believe in this stuff, then being able to like put that into play in your own life. And who knows, maybe you get interviewed for something in September and that's the through line of the story that you wouldn't have been able to tell if you wouldn't have taken that time, right? That it is all part of the larger story.
There you go. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've sort of touched on it a little bit, but when people ask you what you do, how do you describe it?
I say that I am the director of a life coach training program. So that's usually that, like if I'm at a party in my local hometown, you know, something like that, people ask what you do. That's what I say. I'm the director of a life coach training program.
Okay. And can you go into a little bit of detail about what that means and what that looks like?
So my coach training program is called the Courageous Living Coach Certification. And back in 2013, I was, you know, just getting inundated at that point with a lot of questions from different coaches about how to market themselves better. And I would start talking to them. And what I kept finding often was that, sure, there were things for marketing themselves better that would be really helpful, but that there was this common through line in a lot of the conversations I was having where coaches just didn't really feel confident in their skill set. And there were all these places where they'd be like, oh, well, you know, like, I feel like I don't really know how to work with emotion or how to go deep with clients. And, but that's the purview of therapy, right? And so there's this whole development that I started to go into, and I started emailing with the ICF, which is the International Coach Federation. And I don't think it's an accident that around that time, that's when, I mean, I don't know if you'd agree, but around 2013, that's when like Facebook ads just became insane.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, yeah. And I started seeing these Facebook ads all over the place. Become a coach, you know, get your first six-figure month, get your first this and that. And like, I know that ads are being reductive because they're trying to just get across what they hope is an outcome as quickly as possible. And I get that. But there was something about those ads about becoming a coach to get the money, becoming a coach, it's easy. Take this little weekend course where you watch a bunch of videos, that felt, it really chafed at me. Because for me, I've been enormously helped by coaches. I see coaching as craft. I understand that to many people, we are a laughing stock. I get that, that's an industry perception. But I think part of the reason that industry perception is there is because of these stupid fucking Facebook ads.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the coaches who get scared and think that they have to market themselves in similar ways. And so I just kind of went, I want to create something that's really rigorous, that has really great standards, that, you know, that really goes like, okay, like these are people's lives and you have to know when to refer out to a therapist, and you have to know how, you know, how to create a safe container for emotion that's relevant for coaching versus not. And I want a community. I want like fun. I don't want like tick off the core competencies and you're a coach. Like I wanted something much more heart-centered. And so I started creating that. And, you know, to be honest, the reason I reply with, if I'm at a party, so what is it you do? I'm the director of a life coach training program. I just say that because that's the easiest thing, because there still is this perception about coaches that is largely negative. And I just try to keep it at that. And, you know, if anybody pokes around further, it'll be like, oh, okay, you know, what, so what else do you do? What niche do you do? You know, stuff like that. Then I'll talk a little bit more about, you know, I don't really have a niche, but I'll say, well, I predominantly help people to identify their fear-based habits so that they can create more resilient, courage-based habits. You know, just like super straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
And if people poke around too, like, oh, what's that like? I'll say, yeah, I'm the author of the book, The Courage Habit. And then they'll be like, oh, really? So did you, it's funny. Usually their next thing is, so did you self-publish that? It's like, you know, once you say life coach, can't get no respect. But, you know, I gave up trying to convince anyone of the efficacy of coaching if they're not willing to be convinced, or to try to, I don't know. I'm just kind of like, you're in or you're out. I know that what I do rocks.
Yeah.
I know that I've been helped by coaching. I know that I've helped others through coaching. And I know that our training program is fucking bomb. It's amazing. It's great. It brings me to tears on the regular. And there you go.
How did courage become this cornerstone of your work? Like, what was, I don't know if there's maybe an origin story or anything, but it's just, I want to ask, like, why courage?
Well, the reason it connected, I think, I mean, the little threads were there. Like, I remember when I first became a coach, I said I was going to be a creativity coach. And I thought I was going to do that because for me, I tend not to have too much neuroses about creating. It's not always true, but a lot of the time it is true. Like, I tend to just be very like, I want to create that. I'll go paint that. Oh, this would be really cool to learn. I'm going to go to the library and check out 20 books. I'd love to write a piece that explores this topic. That's what I'm going to do. So that's what I thought I would help people with. And what I found was that I ended up really being fascinated about the fear that people had that kept them from doing the creative things that they wanted to do. Like, I was less interested in going, let's make a schedule for you to make art every day, and more interested in going like, how interesting that my painters and my dancers and my writers are all experiencing the same fear. And then running into people where they go, well, I'm not a creative, but would you coach me? I'm an executive. Oh, well, guess what? Executives, same fear. Am I enough? Is there any point to doing this? oh, well, what if it doesn't work out? What if I get criticized? It's all the same bucket of fear.
Yeah.
But it all really coalesced when I was in Italy for the summer back in 2007 or 2008. I had saved up all this money to go to Italy for the summer. That had been like this kind of wild dream for myself. And at the time, I was a teacher living in the San Francisco Bay Area, which means I was making no money. And I was, you know, not even going to teach summer school because I was going to be gone. So it saved up all this money, felt super risky to do. Like, what if I don't like it? What if I'm just hot the whole time because it's really humid in Italy in the summer? What if I just, I'm bored? What if I get robbed, you know, as a tourist? What if I, all these things? So I go and then I love it. Like, why did I think I would be the first person in the history of the world to hate a summer in Italy? I don't know. Fear does these things. But I go and I love it. And I'm walking around every day and walking into downtown Florence and you see the Duomo in the morning light. And it's just like, oh, it's like it feels like God is coming down. You know, it's just so gorgeous. It never gets old. Anyway, so I post on Facebook about how great it is. And in the universe's great gift to me, I get one of those wet blanket Facebook comments about, well, you know, not everybody can do that. And the gift was that it came from someone who I happened to know well enough to know about how much money they made. And they lived in a different part of the world with me, and they had a job that gave them paid vacation. So I was a teacher and I was getting no money in the summer because I wasn't teaching summer school. But like they had paid vacation. So they had all these like resources and paid time at their disposal. And something clicked to me when they made that comment that they had more, you know, access to going to Italy than I did. And they just hadn't. They wanted to, but they hadn't. So what was that about? And it, something clicked for me that, oh, it's about courage. It's like I feel the fear and I'm willing to endure the discomfort of that fear and lean into it, and they aren't yet, right? Like it's, they're not bad people. They're just people who have fear. And something clicked for me, and I was just like, that's what I really want the world to know. Like I often talk with the coach trainees when they are trying to figure out, like, who am I speaking to? What's my messaging? All that stuff. Sometimes I'll ask them the question, like, what is it that in your mind, if the whole world knew this, it would be a better place?
That's such a good question.
Oh, yeah. And to me, that's like, to me, it's like, what I want the world to know is like all these things where you say it can't be done, like it's just your fear talking and you don't need to get rid of it before you go after this thing that you want to do. Like you don't have to get rid of it. It can ride sidecar. Don't let it make your decisions, but you can actually lean into it. You can feel the discomfort of it. You can do it. And it's just fear. And there's nobody who isn't afraid. So you're not alone. You're not weird. You're not failing. It's just fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm obsessed. Courage has become a topic that I'm obsessed with in the last, like, specifically 2 years. Another reason why I was very excited to have this conversation. And one of the things that I like a lot about your work, there's many things, but this idea of the courage habit or like practicing courage, I think that there can easily be a myth that courage is this binary thing. Like you're either inherently courageous or you're not, right? That it's like a quality that you have or you don't. And so I'd love to hear more about your viewpoint of like what it looks like to practice courage or it being essentially like a muscle that you can build the same way that you would with something else.
Okay. Well, first of all, totally accurate. And I, you know, that like you're not born courageous, you become it. So I often think that courage and resilience have a lot in common because for me, courage is feeling afraid. It's not about getting rid of it. It's feeling afraid, diving in anyway, and transforming. And the idea with transforming is that if you move even an inch in the direction of the life you really want, that is transformation. It's not like when the heavens part and life is perfect, you're transformed because that doesn't happen anyway. My life isn't perfect. Your life isn't perfect. Nobody's life is perfect. But you do feel more resilient every single time you go, okay, I'm afraid, but I really want this. I'm going to dive in anyway. And I'm going to start to transform and become more resilient through that process. And with the book, The Courage Habit, the nuance or the flavor that I added to what I was already doing was that it's kind of a great story. I had signed the book deal with my publisher to publish The Courage Habit. And we were at the time just going to call it The Courage Habit, as in like it's a good thing to you know, make courage a habit, like practice it daily. And I mean, this is years ago because publishing moves at such a slow pace. Like I signed the contract ages ago. So I have these chapters due and I'm like, you know what? I kind of want to read about like what actually does create real habits in the brain. So I start doing this research and I find that habits are created in the brain on this cue routine reward loop where you have a cue, you go into a certain routine, and that routine is designed to get to the reward. And the reward is always what's going to create less stress. So a cue of fear when you're going after a big dream for many people results in a fear-based routine. So going into like perfectionism or pessimism, this will never work out, or self-sabotage or martyrdom. Well, I can't go after what I want because they need me, or it's not the right time. I'll be selfish if I do it now. And that's all designed to get to this reward of less stress. And people are like, what do you mean? That sounds pretty stressful. But if you're a perfectionist and you really like control, and I'm raising my hand on that one, and you feel afraid about, I don't know, taking some time off of your business, going into a fear-based routine of perfectionism will temporarily get you the reward of feeling more in control. Mm-hmm. So what we have to do is we have to start looking at where have those behaviors just become habits? They feel out of our control because we've practiced them for so long and they've become these behavioral habits, but they're not. You can change them. You can actually go, okay, I want to have an intervention here. I'm feeling the cue of fear going after what I want. Instead, how about I get conscious and present and I practice habits that the research indicates are going to get me to a reward far better than a temporary reward. And that's where we get into the behaviors that became the courage habit. And that's the flavor of how we get into this. It's like, you know, if you practice what I call the courage habit, you're not going to never be afraid again. What I propose is that it stops becoming your default to go into those fear-based routines and get stuck over mm-hmm. and over and over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really excited to dig into this more. The other kind of top-level thing that I wanted to say before we get into some specifics, I think that people can sometimes have a hard time connecting with the idea of living a courageous life because of how, like, that phrasing is often associated with, like, doing the big flashy things, right? Like, jumping out of airplanes, traveling the world, you know, quitting your job to move to wherever, you know, whatever the things are that it's seen as these like big, like you said, life transformations. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how you see a courageous life playing out, maybe in smaller, more everyday, I don't even necessarily want to say more realistic, because it's not like those other things can't be done as well. But I think that there's a little bit of a disconnect too in how we think about courage, that it's only associated with these like huge things. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And that's a huge thing that I hear too. And I, in fact, in relationship to that, I hear people who say, well, you know, I don't really have issues with fear because they're people who can tick those things off the list. They can skydive or they can travel the world. And so they're like, I don't have issues with fear. I'm like, well, everybody has some kind of issue with fear. So like, maybe yours isn't about that. Maybe yours is about, I don't know, emotional intimacy. Could be. So like, let's start there. Emotional intimacy. It's incredibly courageous to decide to be authentic in a relationship, to say the things that are hard, but without going into a fear pattern where you start tearing someone down and criticizing them. It's incredibly courageous to decide that you're going to take charge of your health and you're going to really look at what you put in your mouth and whether or not it's nutritious and whether or not it totally fucks the environment. And whether or not it actually makes you feel good later, you know, like mm-hmm. sugar tastes great, but you know, most people, if they really pay attention to how it makes their body feel, not so good later. I think it's courageous to decide that you are going to really trust your own instincts as a parent. This is something I run up against all the time living in the parenting culture of Northern California, which is, I think, tending towards more often than not hypervigilance, helicopter parenting, and sometimes even parenting methodologies that I've looked on Google Scholar just to make sure don't actually have clinical support. you know, there's no research that indicates that that parenting methodology turns out better kids. And in fact, more and more research is indicating that the more we hyper-parent our kids, the worse they turn out, because some of those kids, you know, these trends have been going on for about 18, 20 years, and some of those kids are hitting college now, and anxiety rates at college are through the roof. I think it takes courage to speak out on Facebook and say, this political situation is a shit show and it's wrong and we need to work together to change it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes courage to hear the white person at the dinner table make a microaggression and say, you know what? I notice I'm really uncomfortable when I hear you say that. I think it takes courage to sit down and confront your money problems. A lot of people have money problems, and mm-hmm. that's a place where they just kind of like don't want to look at that area and why they have money problems or what it's going to take to get out of them. I think it takes courage just to be who you are. And that's something I hit on this phrase while writing The Courage Habit, that I think the most courageous thing we can do is to make who we truly are on the inside be how we actually live on the outside.
That's so well said. Yeah. And that's one of those things I think that's very easy to tip into cliche, and it's much easier said than done, right? Because like because it's easy to say like, oh yeah, well yeah, I'm doing that. But then to take that moment of pause to be like, am I really? And what are the, maybe I am in some areas, but not in all areas. And how would it feel differently if I were to shift some of those things? Like even as you said that, I was like, oh yeah, oh wait. Yeah.
Yeah. It's integrity.
Yeah.
And integrity is really sexy. And a lot of people think like initially with integrity, it feels like a total killjoy. Like, I have to like be accountable and in integrity. I find integrity to be very joyful. And in fact, one of the feelings that I hate more than any other feeling is knowing that I'm out of integrity and not doing anything about it. Like if I know that I said that thing that really was unkind to that person, and I'm just sitting there knowing that I really ought to make an apology or make an amends, and I don't do it, I hate that feeling. Oh, like I'd rather cry. I'd rather be angry and irritable. I'd rather make an embarrassing mistake, like stumble in front of a bunch of people, than, you know, like know that I was a shithead and I'm not just going to that person and going, here's the thing.
Yeah.
I was not kind to you, and I'm really sorry about that.
The integrity thing and the being like out of alignment, out of integrity. It's one of those things that especially if you're, you know, a clever, intelligent person, it's, I think, simple to do the mental gymnastics of, oh, it's probably fine. Oh, it's not that bad. You know, all the things that stop you from having that, like having to have that hard conversation in the example that you presented. But like, and that could be true. Like you can try to convince yourself of whatever, but in like, you know, in your body, you know what it feels like when you're acting out of accordance with like your values. And there's like only so long I think that we can stand that. Like you can only watch yourself like do shit things for so long.
Well, and the mistake I think in my experience and in my experience in my observations of other people, the mistake that people make is they think that it's like you can, first of all, no one's in integrity everywhere, right? Like I'm not talking about integrity like this hierarchy, like I am in integrity and all the other people. No. Like everybody, nobody's perfect. Everybody's out of integrity somewhere. What I'm talking about is like a consciousness about being in integrity in your life. But the big mistake that I think a lot of people make is they think that if they're not being present to integrity, that life just stays at a baseline. So it's like, oh, like my life could get a little better maybe if I decided I'd really want to be aligned and be in integrity. Or I won't do that and, yeah, life will just kind of continue as it is. No, life doesn't continue as it is, because that process of not being in integrity with yourself and the things you tell yourself, well, I'll take care of it later and da-da-da, it actually makes you weaker.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So it's,
yeah.
It's like, it's not like you could be more integrity if you put in a little more effort, but life is fine as it is. No, life actually gets just incrementally like that lobster in a pot that's slowly heating up, or frog in a pot. That's the invocation. The frog in the pot and the water temperature is changing so slowly it doesn't even realize until it's too late that like there's a real impact here.
Whew, yeah, I think of it often as like the weight of untold truths, which I guess is like a different way to say it. But this idea that yeah, those it, you carried around with you, and it does eat away at you for sure. Yeah, I think that that's so okay. So that makes me want to ask you, when you were talking about the process of like consciously, you know, getting more in alignment, getting more in integrity, making, you know, who you are on the outside match who you are on the inside, being more you, whatever the phrasing is. Can you share an example of something in the past couple of years that you've shifted with that goal in mind?
Well, I mean, entree triathlon training, you know, so I, for years, even back like when you and I met at World Domination Summit and stuff like that, like for years, I was a runner and then I'd get injured and then I'd take time off because I got injured. And I went through infertility in, you know, 2012, 2013. And it looked like I was not going to be able to have a baby. And so I just kind of sat down with my husband and we made this like bucket fuck it list where it's like, all right, if we're going to be dinks, double income, no kids, then like, what's the best possible freaking life we can have, you know? And adoption was on the table as a possibility, because I really wanted to be a mom, but it was like, all right, if that's not what life is right now, what are we going to do with life right now? And I really wanted to do triathlon because I had been admiring these people from afar and getting up to go look at, like, I was like, the signs were all there. I would get up at 5 a.m. to go drive to a race start for my local half Ironman and just like watch the swim wave, you know, and the 10 count. And then I'd like get back in my car and drive home. That's weird, right? Unless secretly you actually want to be a triathlete. There you go. So it was like, that was on my list. I want to train for a half Ironman. So I sign up for one, I start training. And then I get pregnant. So I'm obviously not going to do a triathlon. I have the baby. And, you know, now it's all these years later. But basically, after having the baby, it was like I wanted to do the triathlon again. I was an overwhelmed first-time mother. I didn't know what, you know, this thing happens for most moms that I talk to where like your whole identity outside of becoming a mom has to take such a backseat to the daily care for a baby that it like all collapses and suddenly there's this feeling of like, who the hell am I anymore? I don't even know. Like, I don't even know what it's like to not constantly be thinking about what this tiny little, like, you know, 10-pound nugget needs. So, okay, I have a talk with my husband. I go, I really want to try, you know, training for a triathlon. And I feel so lucky. I went to a spin class at my local gym. There's a woman who lives in my area, Holly Wick, who owns Athletic Souls in Petaluma. I went into her store one day with a baby on one hip. She starts talking my ear off. She's a world-ranked freaking triathlete. Okay. She is like, I mean, she's like 60 and she wins. She's so fast. She's so strong and she will talk your ear off. You want to talk to her about strength training? She will tell you, well, here's what I think. And you, 20 minutes later, you'll be like, I feel like I should pay you for something because you just gave me like a million great ideas. So I basically just like start training for triathlon, but here's what happens at the beginning. And this is where the integrity thing comes in. All right. If you're going to do a triathlon, you've got to have, you know, your training mapped out. You can't do back-to-back-to-back days of running or you'll get an injury. You can't do back-to-back-to-back days of swimming or you'll get an injury too. You get rotator cuff. You have to kind of portion it out and do small bits throughout the week. Well, guess what happens with me? I'm like, oh, but I'm so busy. Oh, but my kid's crying when I'm trying to leave for the gym. I should stay here. Oh, but, you know, she needs me. Oh, but, you know, well, I don't know. I'm feeling kind of sore from that workout yesterday. I don't know if I should do it back to back. What if I get injured? What if the... And it was just like, I had to have this like cut the shit, come to Jesus moment with myself. Not an unkind one. I'm very big on the difference between tough love and confronting with kindness. Tough love is where you beat up on yourself to try to make yourself change. Confronting with kindness is where you're like, look, I got to get real. I'm not doing what I said I was going to do. And I had to really just get real about that and go, all that matters is, did I execute my training plan? So if I'm sore, I do it with less intensity, but I still fucking show up. That's what's happening here. That's what we're doing here. And the benefit of that I learned was actually figuring out that I unfortunately have a high propensity for psychosomatic injury. Like, not the injuries are not real, is what I'm saying. My body will tell me that something is injured that is not actually injured, because I'm so afraid that it's like it goes into my knee or it goes into my shoulder or whatever. I don't understand it. It still happens. I sometimes, when I have a swim workout planned, because I hate the pool, I'll like feel nauseous, like I'm going to throw up. And there's nothing wrong with me. And the second I'm off the pool deck and in the water, it's gone.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to when I used to run and training for running, and the ways that like the physical manifestations of fear around either big workouts, right? Like when you know you have like a big track workout on a Thursday, and like how that would play out like in the body, like even the days beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Like I have a triathlon as of us recording this. I have one in less than a week. And of course, my ankle has been flaring up like crazy, you know, like for no reason, for no reason. I have not suddenly increased my training load or da da da. And I know that it's fake because it goes away. Mm-hmm. Like it goes away. And it like literally last week on Friday, I started thinking about how I had a triathlon, you know, within a certain amount of time, and I put on my running shoes, and I'd had resistance about going running. I'm walking around all morning. I put on my running shoes. I walk out the door and I'm 10 paces past my house, and suddenly my ankle. No way. Come on. No way. I'm walking around all morning with no problem and 10 paces outside my house. That's when I feel something. You know, before I've even started running, I'm still walking. You know, no way. No. Psychosomatic. It's just fear.
It's so interesting how fear manifests in different ways in different areas.
Yeah, yeah. And well, especially because, you know, the ankle, I mean, was my left ankle was like where I had my original injuries that I thought kept me from running. And it's a fascinating thing to watch. And I have like, you know, I have a chiropractor now. I can just ask him. I can be like, all right, is this consistent with a stress fracture? And he'll be like, da-da-da-da-da, look at a couple things. No. Okay. Then I think it's psychosomatic.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned when you were first starting to train, the sort of dealing with leaving your kid to go to the, right? Like she's crying. Should I really go to the gym? All of that stuff. Can you talk a little bit about that? Just like what that transition was like for you? I mean, essentially, I guess I'm asking sort of about time management, sort of about emotional management, because I know that people often say things to you like, I can't believe you do so much plus triathlon, right? You've already mentioned being a mom, being a wife, being a triathlete, being an entrepreneur. So I'd love for you to share just sort of like what the experience was like of adding triathlon and sort of any logistical or mindset shifts that made that easier.
Yeah. So first I'll do logistical because that's a little bit easier. I'm totally of the philosophy that what gets written down on the calendar gets done. So there's that. Enabling my husband to know what I have going on training wise, because I might need a couple of accommodations around this, that, or the other. So conversations about that. Food was a big one, actually. So I went plant-based in 2016 and then went full-on vegan, or I like to say vegan-ish, because there are little things that I'm not going to sweat if there's a little bit of honey in something, stuff like that. And that was in July of 2017. And so food-wise, it just made things a lot easier to come up with a two-week rotating meal plan. And then like post it on the cork board and just like, okay, Mondays we have the vegetarian chili, and Tuesdays we have the, you know, simmer sauce with garbanzo beans and broccoli, and, you know, on down the line. And then there's a whole different meal plan for the second week. And we just keep flipping back and forth between the two. It makes grocery shopping easier. It makes it easy to know like what we're having on any given night. He can start the cooking. I can start the cooking. Doesn't matter who's home. We know what we're having. I would say also lists. So like having a list taped to my garage door of everything I'd need to do for a 50 mile or everything I need to bring for a 50 mile ride. So I don't go out and not have my extra water bottle or my salt tablets or whatever it would be. And tending to do things at the same times was also really, really helpful. So then it's not, if it's like I'm always doing my run at the same time, then it's not a logistical thing to go, well, when am I going to get my run in today?
Mm-hmm.
And so if I always did things at the same time, then I planned appointments around those things rather than planning appointments and then trying to squeeze it all in. So there's all of that, I'd say, that are logistical things. Now, the biggest emotional thing was definitely, you know, am I being completely selfish with my time? You know, given that I started training when my daughter was exactly a year old. I started training in June of 2015 for a sprint triathlon. And it was really hard because I mentioned Holly Wick earlier. Her spin classes are at a set time at my gym. She owns a local shoe store, but she also teaches spin classes at the gym. And I wanted her classes because she's a fount of knowledge and really smart. So I had to make the time to do that. And my daughter would sometimes be in bed before I would get back. And then I'd feel like, God, I didn't get any time with her tonight. And sometimes she'd be crying when I left, like, Mommy, don't go. And, you know, stuff like that. Well, you know what? That was hard. There were times that I hopped into my car and I'd feel guilty and I'd be driving away. And I'd be kind of crying myself. And what it really brought out, though, in the end was, I mean, I think the benefits actually outweigh these nights that I doubt she remembers where I was leaving. I mean, the benefits being things like, you know, my husband and I had fallen into a pretty traditional, like, good cop, bad cop routine around discipline. It's really hard not to, frankly, I think, with a kid. You know, it wasn't intentional, but it was like I would be the one going, this is the, like, limit, because I was with my daughter more than he was at that point in time. And so I knew when she was trying to push boundaries and just being, you know, pulling some shenanigans. But he would be more likely to go, oh, well, maybe just this and this and this. Well, cut her some slack. Well, let me tell you, when he upped his childcare, he started going, we need to put the kibosh on the shenanigans, you know? So there was a lot more egalitarian work around parenting, work around starting dinner, work around childcare pickups and drop-offs. And I think that was really important. And then the other thing I think it did too was me not being so hyper-focused on parenting and having this other thing in my life that has nothing to do with my business, and nothing to do with being a parent and nothing to do with being a wife, but solely for me, so helpful. And then, I mean, by the time you train for a half Ironman and you have a really low resting heart rate, it's like, holy shit, this feels so good. I feel so much better than I've ever felt in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's so much good stuff in what you just shared. I think the thing that's coming through for me strongest is this idea of, like, asking yourself, like, really specifically, what do I need in order to make this work? Because I think that one of the most common traps for what, you know, not closing the gap between what we say we want and what we actually do is because we hold it in this sort of, like, vague, amorphous, like, oh, that just can't happen, or that's too complicated, or I don't have time. But for you to actually say, okay, like, something that would make this easier is a rotating 2-week meal plan. And that looks like this. Something that would make it easier is doing my runs all at the same time. Like, once you start to nail down the specifics, both logistically and emotionally, of what you need, and basically, like, taking the time to name those things and then set them up, I think a lot of things are more possible than we initially believe.
It's sovereignty over your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if I say that I usually do my runs at, like, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So if I say I'm going to do a run at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I can't have life where I'm only eating lunch at 2:30. You know, I can't, like, you know, so then that ends up making me more accountable around when I have lunch, which makes my whole work day a better flow, because getting into this whole headspace of, like, oh, well, I'll get lunch later, I'm going to push it back, I'm going to do this or that. It's like, no, can't do that. Because if I do, it screws up the other things that I want to have done or that I want to give myself. And I think, too, that the other thing that really bore out in that training, in addition to the integrity and in addition to, you know, the benefits around parenting, was, you know, that missive about, you know, what is it you're doing in your life today that's going to contribute to your life 30 days from now or a year from now. And training for a big event like this that there's nothing else really like it, where you really get to see the results so concretely. It's easier to kind of skip out on it and go, well, you know, it was a busy year, so that's why I didn't get my book proposal written. But with training, like you can't show up on your training day and not having put the miles in. You just can't. I mean, or you can, but you get injured and it'll suck.
Mm-hmm. Something that's related to this, but maybe like a little bit of a pivot, and this is totally a selfish question because it's something that I've been thinking mm-hmm. about right now while I'm trying to train for this hike. I've had a really tough time. I think this is particularly related to how long hike training takes. Like, my only experience of regularly training for something is with running, that even with marathons, I mean, the longest run was still like a couple hours, right? Whereas now, if I'm going to do like 15, 18 miles, I mean, it's like 5-6+ hours of hiking, not, you know, with breaks, with driving to and from trail. Like, it's a lot, right? And so I've been struggling with how to be present in the thing that I'm doing. Like, when I'm working, I feel like, oh my gosh, I need to be training. Like, I'm not trained enough for this hike. And then when I'm hiking, I spend the whole time like being stressed out about work. And so I'm curious how you handle that.
I listen to the fear. That becomes the thing I become present to. Like, I try to make that. So if I'm, well, first of all, I'm happy to make anything an exercise for releasing stress. During 2016, when I was training, there was this person who was coming after me about some trademark shenanigans. It was completely ridiculous and you know, just a total shit show. And I was, you know, feeling angry about it. And I would go out on runs and I would imagine myself stomping on her face every step, you know, because otherwise, and is that juvenile? Well, of course it is. If I really think, like, if that's who I really am, that's not who I really am. That was how I was choosing to get out all of the petty, angry feelings I was having about the inconvenience that this person was bringing into my life. And I was doing it in that way so that it wouldn't come out in other ways. So I look at it like, hey, like, if you're stressed, I mean, trust me, I went on some interesting runs right after the 2016 election. Okay. Like, you know, stomping on faces, like, that's a catharsis exercise right there. And then I think too, that it's the voice that comes up really harsh for me whenever I am overtraining as in just, I have a really heavy training load and it's taking me away from other things, is like, this is so stupid. This is so pointless. Who cares if you even run these miles? Who cares if you know, so what? So you're out on a bike in Sonoma County. Who cares? Doesn't even matter. Doesn't help. So it's like, okay, I actually kind of try to get, when I can, as soon as I can, get present to the fact that my head is running that loop. It's like, okay, who's talking right now? Like, I don't think we often stop to think about that. Like, who's actually talking when that voice comes up? What's the part of me that's talking? And what I find is that it's the fear. It's this fear that, you know, feels more in control when it's angry. And why? Okay, so who's it coming? Who is it? It's my fear. Okay, why? Because I actually don't know if I'm going to be able to bring it on race day. Because I don't know if I'll be able to bring it on race day. And so then I'm afraid of how I'm going to feel if I can't bring it on race day. I've never DNF'd. I don't intend to start anytime soon. I'm one of those people where, like, if I have to limp across that finish line, I'll be limping. But I'm afraid of, I don't know how I'll feel about myself if I don't follow through or something. And so I just try to get like, okay, like, what's the tenderness I can bring to that voice? What, like, how can I just go, okay, this is what's coming up for you. And yeah, it will feel pretty shitty if we can't finish this. So let's just get this done. And what's a great reward for the time we're investing in this right now? You want to chill out on the couch with magazines later? You know, call a friend. Maybe you need to turn on some music, playlist. What's it going to be? You know? Mm-hmm. So that's the space I go into. And I guess you can probably tell by my affect how the voice sounds in my head and how I actually even try to just slow down and like talk to that voice. I think a dialogue with our fear is enormously helpful.
Do you find that for you personally, that there are some core fears that come up again and again, like in different areas of your life?
Yes. Yes. Not being liked. That's a really hard one for me. Especially because as somebody who will tell it like it is, I have absolutely been written off as just a total bitch. Like that moment of me getting righteous about something that's important to me or being willing to tell it like it is, or sometimes just, you know, times in my past or in the moment, maybe I don't have access to the social skill in that moment required to really deliver something that's true with kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And being rejected. I've been rejected for that, and being rejected for that is extremely difficult to me. I can totally spin out in feeling like I'm unworthy and not enough and nobody likes me, and and if anybody else knew what this person thinks of me, then nobody would like me. You know, I mean, there's a lot of that. Fears that I'm not doing enough for the world come up sometimes. That I'm not living a life that gives enough back. I find it incredibly devastating to read news headlines and see people suffering. And I find it kind of devastating that there's not more that all of us can do, that the system is so much bigger than we are. And that doesn't mean that I think, as in the system is so much bigger, thus there's nothing that can be done. I do believe that we will overthrow it and change it and make it better. But what I find devastating is that there's nothing that can really be done like soon and fast because of how big the system is. Mm-hmm. Like there's nothing that any one of us can do today that's going to stop unarmed Black people from getting shot during routine traffic stops or on sidewalks. There's nothing that any one of us can do today that's going to make sure that food and provisions get to Puerto Rico. Like that saddens me. It's devastating. There's nothing any of us can do today to stop, you know, what's going on in Syria. Mm-hmm. It's you know, all of us together will make change. I believe that. But it's so sad to me that there's not more that I can do. And sometimes I fear that I have a hidden spot that I'm not even seeing, and it's right in front of me. And I don't know if that makes any sense.
But yeah, it definitely makes sense. Yeah. And I think that that's a very honest answer. And because the reason I asked that question is because when you were talking earlier in the conversation about, you know, the fears that were coming up with artists that you worked with versus CEOs that you worked with, right? That it's like I think there aren't that many core fears. Like maybe people, like we all have the same fears. And I think that it's really comforting to hear people speak honestly about it the way that you just did. Cause maybe, you know, the thing that comes up for you the most is different than the thing that comes up for me the most, but the thing that comes up for me the most would be the same as, you know, for thousands and thousands of other people. Right. So it's like, I think it's just really helpful to have some honesty around that, particularly when there is no capital A answer, right? You're not saying like, okay, here's how to never like have this fear again. Like that's not how that works, but to just be like, okay, this is the fear that comes up for me. And I think just having some awareness around, like for me, one of the ones that comes up a lot is a fear of being too much or being seen mm-hmm. as too much. Mm-hmm. And that's played out in literally every single area of my life. And so it's like even being awake to that lets me recognize that fear when it's coming up.
Yeah. Man, so you just said it in a different way, but like exact same fear. Basically, that's it. That my anger will be too much, or that my opinion will be too much, or just that, what's the too much about, or the not enough about? Not enough or too much, right? They're both in there. And it's because, well, if you're too much, well, then what? Well, then people won't like me. And if people won't like me, well, then what? Well, then I'll be alone. I won't be loved. Mm-hmm. That's really what is at the core for all of us, is if I'm alone and I'm not loved by others, I might not know how to love myself to compensate for that. And if I don't know how to love myself, then what will be the point of existing? Like, I think it actually goes to that deep hole. And I have a piece somewhere on my website where I actually talk about this whole thing of like people who are like, I give no fucks and I don't care what other people think. Da, da, da. Like, I'm just like, well, I don't care what other people think to a degree that I'm going to allow it to impact my choices on a pretty regular basis. I'm still going to go do the triathlon. I'm still going to write the book. Even if people laugh at me, I'm still going to show up online. I'm still going to show up for the interview. I'm going to advocate for my kid in the way that I think, you know, she should be treated when she's out of my care at school. And her teachers probably aren't going to like me very much for that. There are certain things I'm going to do, but I always care from a human perspective. Like who can honestly say that if a bunch of people pile on with criticism, well, I just don't give any fucks. So yeah, you do. Maybe not enough to let it control your behavior, but there's a human moment where it hits you because you're a human being and because other people might be being unkind in that moment.
I mean, yeah, not being liked, being criticized literally never feels good. And yeah. I think this goes back to the underpinnings, like the idea behind your book, right? This like of courage being a habit and, you know, sort of being able to let go of fear-based habits as much as possible and sort of replace them with other things. Like, I do think, because it's easy to be like, oh, well, these are the fears and these always come up. So like, shrug, too bad, nothing we can do. And so, but I like the idea of having some tools in place, because I don't hear you saying that your goal is to be fearless or to not have these fears or that that's even a realistic thing to expect, because I don't think that it is. And I know that you feel that way too. And so it more becomes like, what are the tools in your toolbox that help make the, you know, manifestations or appearances of those fears not be so debilitating?
Absolutely. And I think of it in my own head as being kind of like, if you could imagine like you're standing in a circle, and that circle is like maybe only like you're like it's kind of tight around you. And it's like when you first start engaging with that work, that edge, that container of the circle, that's where people can get to you, right? But then you do a little bit more courage work and your circle gets wider. You're still in the center of it, but now the center to the edge of the circle is 3 feet in all directions. And that's now the entry point where something can get to you. Your fear can convince you that you shouldn't try, or somebody else's criticism makes you ruminate for weeks. And then you practice this work a little bit more and suddenly the circle is like, you know, 10 feet away from you and in all directions. And that's how I see this work being. It's like I had a podcast interview and somebody, you know, came and after I posted about it, like posted some long thing about all these ways that I was posted a Facebook comment about all these ways that I was a fraud and this and that and the other. And it's like, I know that 10 years ago, that comment would have like, I'd be reading it on Facebook. My heart would start pounding. I would know that he wasn't saying things that were true, and I would know that he was saying things that were unkind, but something in me would probably be going, has he figured out something about me that everybody sees and I just don't get? Oh my God. But it's like, you know, now all these years later, it's almost like I was kind of laughing. I was like, like, you know, it was something about how I'm a fraud and how he can tell that I really am still afraid. And I was just sitting here like, yeah, dude, I am. Like, you missed the point here. Like, I still have things I'm afraid of. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, this is not landing for me as something that I'm gonna. So it's just like your container for what you can hold really expands the more you do this work. It's not that there are no places of penetration where the stuff doesn't hit you. It's that it expands. And it is contextual. You brought that up earlier. Like, are there some contexts where it's different? It's like, yeah, I've got family members where the circle where they can penetrate with their criticism is a lot closer to me than some dude I've never met online.
Right. Right. Do you have a favorite starting point for this work? I know that's kind of a big question, but you know, this idea, I'm really interested in this idea of identifying fear-based habits and, you know, starting to let go of them. Do you feel like there is a starting point or a way in for this?
Well, first, knowing what your predominant fear pattern is. And okay. I have a bunch of that, you know, worksheets and ways of questioning that in the courage habit. So there are 4 predominant fear patterns: perfectionism, martyrdom, also called people pleasing, pessimism, and self-sabotage. And I am of the belief that you can't change something that isn't working in your life without knowing and being clear about what isn't working. You can't just go, you know what? I want to be somebody who's a triathlete, or I want to hike the PCT. you can't just go straight to that without knowing the things that are likely to trip you up and cause you to like not, you know, get there or do whatever you set out to do. So knowing for me, knowing that my we all do all of these, perfectionism, martyrdom, pessimism, self-sabotage, we all do all of them, but usually one is more of a hook than the others. So for me, knowing that perfectionism is a predominant pattern for me means that when I'm going after something that is like my moonshot goal or, oh my gosh, this would be big or this feels like a stretch, it's like, where am I going into perfectionism, trying to control it, trying to be beyond judgment? Where am I going into that place? So that's a big one. After that, you know, so the four behaviors that I identified in the courage habit that, and this is not me inventing them. I consider myself more of a synthesizer. I'm somebody who researched the ideas and then started making these connections between them that really were interesting and that were backed up by research. And those behaviors are accessing the body, listening without attachment. So listening to what the fear says, but not attaching to it as true. Reframing limiting stories. So going from I can't to I'm willing to try. It's not positive affirmations, but just reframing the limit and then reaching out and creating community. And what most of us want to do with fear is jump straight into like listening without attachment and reframing the stories and not being in our bodies. And I'd say if you know what your fear pattern is, next step, access the body. That's where my money is, because that's where the vulnerability is really felt. We feel fear in our bodies first before we make any kind of story about what it means. So if I'm getting into perfectionism, it's like, okay, well, where do I need to like be angry or where do I need to cry? Like, where do I actually just need to sit down in my office and make space for what I call conscious crying, which is like almost like a meditation practice, but instead of breathing, like sitting down and seeing, is there anything I need to cry out? Like anything that's pent up that hasn't been released? That's my go-to body-based stuff.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, there's so much good stuff. I feel like I'm just like trying to take in everything that you're saying. With perfectionism being your, like you said, the most, I don't know, reoccurring for you of the four, I feel like sometimes with words like perfectionism, you know, martyrdom, people pleasing, these kind of things, I think there's like an initial level at which we all understand what those words mean, but sometimes like a disconnect between being able to recognize like when we're actually doing it or what that actually looks like. So I would love if you feel comfortable, if you would share like what an example of what perfectionism looks like in your real life. Like, how does that actually play out? Or like, what are the things that you catch yourself doing where you're like, oh, this thing right here is me being perfectionist?
Well, I go with perfectionism can look like having impossibly high standards. And that definitely shows up in my life. And for instance, when I said earlier, I have this fear that I'm not doing enough for the world, I think that's an example of perfectionism that's about having impossibly high standards. It's like I expect of myself, because I see so much suffering in the world, this impossibly high level of standards around how my behavior must be and how much I must advocate. And then I know that I'm missing the mark on that. And then I'm I'm critical of myself for missing the mark, and I'm angry at myself for missing the mark. But I also have this other way that perfectionism really shows up. And I'd say I heard Brené Brown talk about perfectionism as being not just the standards, but being about being beyond judgment. And when I heard that really landed for me, because especially with other people, I don't really, with my business, with writing, I don't have this thing where I'm like, I need to be the best, like that kind of perfectionism. It's almost off-putting to me, people who think they need to be the best at things. Cause I'm just kind of like, why? Because then that sets you up to be disconnected from everybody else. Cause you're the best over there. And then everybody else is not the best. And there's something about that I've never liked. But trying to be beyond judgment. So that would look like, really ruminating on how I handle something or how I say something and going, well, did I say that right? Could I have said it better? Should I go back? Should I edit? Should I, you know, like, will they say this now? Will this be the next criticism? Will this be the next thing? And I'd say that that plays out the most with particular family members that I don't have good relationships with. Mm-hmm. It's like it's almost like a perfectionistic self-consciousness about trying to show up in a way that is going to keep them from managing to see one of my weak spots, which they will then capitalize on and make some passive aggressive comment about when I least expect it and am least prepared for it.
Yeah, this idea of trying to almost like preemptively micromanage mm-hmm. how you're going to be received to avoid criticism.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Hmm. Interesting. And
I noticed that like on my book tour, feeling like, I don't know, it's funny. The like, will I look fat thing came up like on book tour, like on, you know, a photo, you know, nobody sees my whole body usually, but will people look at me and think that I, you know, cause I have a couple extra pounds that I'm, you know, and that's conditioning and I get that, but it's still, you know, that's the type of thing that comes up. Will people take unflattering photos of me on my book tour and post them and, you know, mock or critique my body or think, wow, she doesn't really have it together. Look at her. She could stand to lose a few pounds. Or that was like a weird thing for me to come up. But it was, you know, if I'm on Real Talk Radio, I'm going to tell the truth about stuff that came up, you know, but that's the type. Or I noticed I had like my response kind of prepared in case any of the teachers at my daughter's daycare had anything to say about the fact that I was going on book tour. You know, if my daughter's behavior was different than usual. I noticed it around veganism, like having, you know, this kind of, you know, defensiveness around both people who think veganism and plant-based diets are ridiculous, as well as the contingent of vegans who are like, you're not vegan enough.
Yeah. Yes. Listen, I one of the most empowering things that I did for myself was deciding and then putting in my, this is going to sound so silly, but and then putting in my Instagram bio that I'm 96% vegan, because like you, I'm not 100% vegan, and words mean stuff and I get that. And so maybe that was preemptively, you know, not having anybody give me shit about it, right? When I'm like on trail and eating pancakes, that's fine. Right. But yeah, there it definitely is an element of that for sure. And the sort of like pre-preparing a defensive thing, I also felt that a lot in early sobriety for me, like when mm-hmm. I quit drinking. And it's been interesting now that it's been 7 years that I don't feel that way at all. So sometimes I feel like it's like a coping mechanism, right? Like preparing what you're going to say so you don't wilt under it because your own belief in the thing isn't strong enough yet. And now there's like literally nothing that anybody could say to me about not drinking. Like I would not give any fucks, right? If someone was like, that's true. Oh, well, you know, you're not as fun or you're not this. I'm like, that's cool. Like, I'm doing way better. It's fine. You know,
you just described what we've been talking about, right? Like it became habitual for you to like, you know, and now the resilience is there and your fence is like really far away for an entry point. Like maybe there's some kind of part of you that could feel hurt that someone's for some reason deciding to make you not drinking about like who you are. But you know, it's just like, yeah, that's not going to like sway my decision or make me. Yeah. So it's, yeah, it's stuff like that that comes up. And then too, like, you know, I mean, I'm human and my husband and I have a pretty incredible marriage on a lot of different fronts, but sure. Yeah. When I'm pissed and I'm triggered and I'm tired and he's pissed and he's triggered and he's tired, we've said things to one another that are just absolutely abhorrent that you thank God there's no video camera following you around all day. And, you know, like feel shame about that, you know, stuff like that too. I'm trying to think if there was anything else that I'm really just like the perfectionism coming, you know, like, oh, wouldn't want anyone to see me not being perfect there. But that's a lot of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I'm so grateful for the honesty. Something not really related to exactly what you were just sharing, but that I was thinking of earlier when you were talking about essentially like the benefit of, you know, enacting the courage habit or developing courage as a habit in order to help you pursue the things that you want to pursue. I have to think about how to phrase this so that this is articulate, because this is something that's just been bouncing around in my brain. But I've been thinking lately about sort of the struggle or the dichotomy of trying to answer the question of like, am I not doing X thing because I'm afraid, because I'm getting triggered by, you know, fear-based habits, all of that? Or is X thing just a fantasy that I'm using to escape? Like, I've been thinking about sort of the relationship between fear, idealism, never being present or satisfied. Like, I think there's something in there that I don't quite have a handle on, and maybe this doesn't make sense to you and you're like, question mark, but is there anything in there that you like you've either learned or like learned for yourself or that you'd want to talk about?
Yes. So what I hear in your question is something along the lines of like, is deciding to hike the PCT a diversion from like real life or from dealing with fear? Or is it like really what I want to do? And is it something along the lines of that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and that's a good example. We can use that example as like a way to talk about it. But yeah, just, I think this comes up for a lot of people like, oh, you know, I really want to write a book, or I really want to, you know, monetize this thing and have a side business, or I want to, you know, take Kate's coaching certification thing, right? These, I want to do it. And then there's the gap between, you know, maybe what triathlon was for you, the gap between, you know, thinking that you want it or fantasizing about it or talking about it and then actually doing it. It's like knowing the difference between like, am I not doing this because of fear? Like, or is thinking about this just something that like makes me feel good and helps me escape my life? Like, would I be better served being just like more present and more satisfied with what I have? Something in there, I think, is a really common experience.
Totally. And we could also use, you know, is doing half Ironman that for me? Because I absolutely have had that question. Okay. So here's what I think. One, the big ringer is how kindly are you talking to yourself about quitting or staying the course? So it's like, if it is like, you know, God, you know, you're so weak. Why don't you just keep pushing? It's like, you got to look at how you're talking to yourself, because I think a voice of wisdom doesn't speak to you like you're a piece of shit. Mm-hmm. A voice of wisdom comes in and might be very direct with you. A voice of wisdom comes in and might say, hey, maybe you need to ease back a little bit. But a voice of wisdom to try to get you to take a particular behavior does not go, you should have known better. Come on. You know, that's not a voice of wisdom. So that's one thing. But the other thing that I think is important is that we need to give ourselves more room around discernment, because we forget that the only way to learn discernment is through fucking up discernment. Like, you aren't going to know. I just think of myself in my 20s. There was no way I was going to know if going, it's cool, why not have a one night stand, was really just like me being like sexually free and open, or me making a choice that actually was disrespectful to who I am or what I want, or, you know, if it was just a diversion from, or a fear that I can't have a good relationship anyway, so I might as well sleep with that guy, you know? Mm-hmm. I found that last year, actually. So in 2016, I trained for a half Ironman. In 2017, I signed up for another half Ironman, and I just had a really rough training year. And I got bronchitis for like 6 weeks, and had to go on antibiotics and an inhaler and a whole bunch of stuff. I lost a bunch of training time, but I'm like, all right, I'm going to pull it together. I go do this Olympic distance triathlon in June. And because of the lack of consistency in training, it was like I was doing the swim that day, and I was just like, I don't want to do this. This is fucking bullshit. I don't want to do this. This is the biggest waste of time. Why am I here? You know, all the voices I've told you about before. And I finished that race, and I was just wasted. I was gassed. I was bombed. I was just everything. And I ended up deciding I'm not going to train for this half Ironman. In 2017, I give up. This is too hard, and I don't have enough time, and this feels like crap, and I don't even want to do it anymore. Well, September 10th was the day in 2017 when I would have done the half Ironman. And wouldn't you know, about a month after that crappy race, so I give up training the day after that race. I'm like, I'm done. I'm done for the year. It's not happening this year. Well, wouldn't you know, a month after giving up on that race, I'm totally flooded with like, oh, I wish that I had done it. And like, it's getting too close to the actual race day for me to catch up. I haven't been running. That's just asking for a stress fracture to like, boom, you know, suddenly try to run a half marathon and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, and September 10th, like the whole week leading up, I was like, if I had kept my training, I would have been doing this week. I would have been tapering. And then September 10th, I felt like I cried. I was like, God, like I wasn't there. So that's how you learn discernment, through fucking up discernment, mm-hmm. which means that this year, when I go to an Olympic distance triathlon that's a couple months out from the half Ironman, if I have a really crappy day, what I need to know, because I learned from discerning this, is if I feel really crappy, I go, okay, this is how I feel today. This doesn't mean it's how I'm going to feel a month from now. Doesn't mean it's how I'm going to feel on race day for that half Ironman.
Yeah, this idea that clarity comes through action and like experimentation, and there's no, I found that to be true, that there's like really no other solution.
Yeah, I mean, we all want like the perfect, you know, the 6-step process for the 5-part plan for the 4 ways that you can incrementally improve your life with the 3 benefits that you can get in 2 easy payment plans. It's just like, no, like life doesn't work that way. You're going to sleep with the wrong people. You're going to get drunk and realize, you know, 1 too many times and realize you need to quit. You're going to train too hard and get injured. You're going to train not hard enough and not bring it on race day. You're going to walk into speaking out about something political and totally not stay in your lane and have people criticize you over that. You're going to do all those things. You are, because we're all learning, and we need to make more room for the discernment that comes only through, I think, either making mistakes or really integrating somebody else's mistake. You know, mm-hmm. sometimes we can hear of somebody else making a mistake and we can learn from that and integrate from that. But a lot of times we have to go see for ourselves.
Yeah. And then I think too, circling back to my very inarticulate original question that you did a good job of helping me to frame, this sort of being able to tell the difference between, right, like something that you actually want and are afraid to pursue versus something that's just like a fantasy. I also do think that longevity is an issue too. Like, what are the things that keep coming up, right? That, mm-hmm. like, and I mean, I think I'm working on my first book right now. I think about that a lot with writing a book. Like, that's something I've wanted to do since I knew what books were. So, okay, at some point, like, it's been a really long time. So, obviously, I want to do that. So, any of the things in the way are fear-related things, as opposed to other things that might be like a passing fantasy, you know, about a potential other life because of what something I saw on Instagram that, like 3 weeks later, I'm like, oh, I don't actually want that thing. That's fine. You know?
Yep.
So the last thing that I would love to ask you, because you said that a lot of your process for this book and some of the things that we've talked about was, you know, doing a lot of research and synthesizing it. So with the research that you have done on habits specifically, what pinged for you that felt really relevant of the difference between habits that stick and habits that don't? And obviously it's a huge topic, but was there any one thing that like came up that you were like, huh, that's surprising and interesting and, you know, that stuck with you?
Well, the piece of research that I found most interesting wasn't necessarily habit driven, although I think it's related. And it was actually around goal setting. And it was the idea that, so they did this research where they gave people, 2 different groups of people, set goals. And the researchers, I don't think they told the participants, but the researchers, based on the type of goal that a person had set, determined whether it was a compassionate goal or a success-driven goal. So compassionate goals were goals that in some way benefited other people. So it's the earning the money for the run that's going to go to charity when you complete the run versus just doing a run because you want to do a run. And what they found was that not only were the people who set the compassionate goals more likely to meet their goal than people who set purely success-driven goals, but they had a lot more fun along the way, which I think is important because in any goal, you're going to have moments where you're going, what am I doing this for? Why am I even doing this? So that shifted something for me around the idea that I guess what it shifted or what it connected for me was really going, like, we need to let people in. Like, I get such enjoyment, actually, and I would imagine you do too. When somebody is doing something and they're really believing in themselves and going after it, I get a little vicarious thrill out of that. Mm-hmm. It's exciting to me. I'm happy for them. you know, to hear that you, like you just said, you're working on your book, and to hear that, I'm like, I actually felt something in my body that's just very like, oh, this is really cool. Nicole's working on a book. Yeah. So it's, I think that when we let other people in, that it makes the experience so much more richer. It makes us more successful. And I think that's important because one of the things that I sometimes have historically done with goal setting is not let people in, because if I don't let anyone know what I'm up to, then they won't know if I fail.
Right.
Which is, you know, classic perfectionism. But it's like, you let people in, and it's just, I mean, the most joyful part of getting the Courage Habit out into the world was like getting to hug people when I was on book tour who I had been interacting with online forever and I never got to meet in person, and getting to answer questions and laugh with people in real time and get out from behind the internet. I just think there's this, when we think about how who we are being can benefit other people and there can be a reciprocity to that, I just think it's really motivating and helpful. And I don't know, that's what comes up for me when I think of your question. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other thing that's kind of changed my life, I don't know that this is totally what you were asking, but I will say habit formation has changed my life in a big way with how I parent my daughter. Because a lot of, you know, she's 4 now, and a lot of parenting at this age is trying to figure out how to not limit curiosity, but also how to have a limit, because limits are necessary and healthy. And I've found that habit formation helps with not having to say no a lot. So it's like, or to issue commands a lot. So like there's a habit we have of when we've been out running an errand, first thing she does is she takes off her shoes and she goes for a potty break. And now she just does it on her own without me even saying anything, which takes one more thing I might need to nag about off my plate.
Mm-hmm.
When it's bedtime, she knows that the habit is we read a story, you walk straight into your room to go to bed. We do not pass go. We do not pick up a toy. We do not spend extra time snuggling. Sorry, snuggle has to happen before story, because story, walk into your room and into bed, is the pattern. And now she will just get up from the story and she will walk straight into her room, which reduces the stress of bedtime shenanigans. So I don't know why that came up, but that's the other thing. It just really changed my life as a parent. It feels good to like give her habits that then make our day smoother.
I'm glad that it came up, because the thing, as someone who's not a parent and does not plan to be, the thing that pinged for me, I mean, I think we're always looking for like points of relatability and honest things that other people share. Like what I thought of was like, oh, this also applies to parenting yourself. Like, why am I making it so hard? Where I have to like nag myself all the time to just like have some habits that, yeah, put some energy there. So obviously we're about halfway through the year now. What does practicing courage look like for you for the rest of 2018? I know that's intentionally a vague question, but anything that comes up that you want to share?
Yeah. So it looks like not planning. So I'm very much somebody who, I'm passionate. I have a lot of ideas and I get excited and I go, I want to put those ideas into place. Like, why not? Why would I wait? Let's do it. This is the nice thing about living a courageous life, is that when you get an idea, you're kind of like, cool, let's execute, instead of most of the time. And I'm really clear that I do need a break for the summer and I need to just like not be putting things on my plate and doing things. And that is really kind of my plan for the foreseeable future, is to not make a plan until September. The only thing that I really have that I really want to make sure I do this year is get into weightlifting. That sounds like a really weird thing, but it's something I've been resisting for a long time. But I have an autoimmune disease and I have family members who have different autoimmune diseases than me that, let me back up a little bit. So I have an autoimmune disease, a couple of them. And then I have family members who started with the same ones that I did and later developed autoimmune type 1 diabetes. So given that we share the same genetics, it has been a concern of mine for a while that that could happen with me. So I'm like, okay, what can I do? What does research indicate that I could do? And it's get into weightlifting, and I resist weightlifting. So I'm just like, okay, I need to get into weightlifting. Hmm. So that's like a random answer.
No, I love it.
It's not very sexy, but
it doesn't, I mean,
get into weightlifting.
The real answers are like never sexy. No, that's a fun place to wrap up. So the way that we end these episodes, as I think you know, are with some random rapid fire ish questions. Essentially, the Patreon community, the folks who fund the show and support the show, basically we come together and pick seven questions that all eight guests this season answer the same seven questions. If you're down to answer some random questions.
Let's do it. Lightning round.
Lightning round. Yeah, I need like an actual name for this segment. I just like stumble through explaining it every single time. But the first question is about money. So when it comes to money, what's one thing that you purposefully don't spend much money on? And then on the flip side, what's one thing that's a totally worthwhile splurge for you?
God, such a good question. Okay. Expensive sunglasses. I will drop them or lose them. I don't spend money on that. And purposely we'll spend money on good food and supplements, because mm-hmm. if you don't have your health, you don't have anything.
What's one thing that you really love about yourself?
How deeply I feel, my integrity, and how deeply I feel and how deeply I care.
What was a recent shift or decision that you made that's had a really big impact in your life?
That I want to be softer.
What do you mean?
Softer. I want to slow down and not immediately think about reaction. So I just want to be softer. I just want to kind of, if something isn't happen easily, to go, okay, I don't need to like muscle this one through. If it's not happening easily, maybe I just need to breathe, mm-hmm. be softer.
Yeah.
I don't need to get righteous. I just, okay, cool. That's your feeling on it. I'm not going to defend myself. Like let's just be softer.
Yeah. Looking back, what's one decision that at the time felt incredibly hard for you to make?
Deciding to start my business, deciding to step outside of traditional safe, secure, air quotes, safe, secure employment.
If anything were possible, what's one of your big dreams or fantasies?
For my life or for the world?
How about one of each?
Okay. If anything were possible for the world, I would want us to all come together and really get for serious about the environment. That would be the, if anything were possible there. Mm-hmm. If anything were possible for me, okay, because if anything's possible, I'll pick two. For in my career, it would be for, my business to grow to the point where it was just really clear at all times. Like this is like the numbers to be where I want them to be in terms of finances and bringing on full-time employees and stuff like that. And then for just my life, it would be like infinite patience. Like I would want to be one of those people who just like, it's just like, oh, I just want to love you. And I never get hooked by going like, will you quit being an asshole? Like, it would just be infinite patience.
That's such a good answer. The next question is about books. Which, let's say, two or three books of any genre, any type of book, would you say have either had the biggest impact on you or that you recommend or reread most often?
Pema Chodron, When Things Fall Apart.
Ugh, so good. So good. I think that's probably, I'm going to bring the audiobook of it on my hike.
Yeah. Sherry Huber, There Is Nothing Wrong With You. Also been a big one. I know that a lot of people go back and forth on Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week. Like, I don't dig everything he's about. I don't dig everything that's in the book. But the idea of lifestyle design and kind of hacking it to not always like think you have to go through the gatekeepers and stuff, like that was really helpful. Danielle Laporte, her work has influenced me a lot. And then just recently, one of the most beautiful books I've looked at is Sonia Renee Taylor's The Body Is Not an Apology.
Yeah, I read that recently too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like, just even the cover, if anybody just goes look at the cover on Amazon, I'm like, oh, this is a powerful woman.
yeah, that's someone who's on my wish list for a future podcast guest, for sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The last question, if you could leave our community, the listeners, with one call to action, what would it be? Maybe a question to ask themselves or a small action to take?
Take 5 minutes to do the thing that you know that you need to do that you've been resisting doing.
Oh my God, I feel like you see into my soul.
Like, just take the 5 minutes. Like, if you know you need to make an apology, take 5 minutes to write the apology out. Maybe you don't have the time to have the hour-long conversation. Or if you know you need to, like, if you've been listening to, like, if you're a Nicole fan because you see her doing all this cool shit, like, endurance-wise, and you're like, I've always wanted to do that, but I couldn't do that. It's like, get your butt outside and take a 5-minute walk. If you know that you, you know, feel kind of devastated by the political nature of things and you need to cry, like, sorry, it's going to be a little tough, but yeah, sit down for a minute and just like cry for 5 minutes. Like, give yourself a break for 5 minutes. Give yourself a judgment-free zone for 5 minutes. Start working on your book proposal for 5 minutes. Look at sites about how to, you know, sell everything and travel the world for 5 minutes. Work on your marriage for 5 minutes. I, you know, whatever it is for you, you know what it is. I tend to think that people go, when they go, well, I don't really know what I want. Yeah, you do. Like, deep down, yeah, you do. You do. You do. Come on. Truth, truth, truth. You know. It's just super scary. So, like, 5 minutes of being gentle with yourself, because there's a super scary thing that you know you haven't done that you really want to do. Like, 5 minutes.
That's such a good call to action. This could also be a whole other conversation another time about how much I agree with what you just said about getting stuck in the, well, I don't know what to do. Like, I think so much of asking for advice is basically just like either looking for validation for the thing that you already know that you want to do, but you're afraid, or you know the what, but you don't know the how, or like, we do know. Like, it's very infrequently, I think, that people don't actually know if they're really honest with themselves. So yes, I love that call to action. What's the best place for people to find you and your work and to say hi online? Do you have a favorite way to connect with new folks?
Yeah, you can head to yourcourageouslife.com. You can go to yourcourageouslife.com/begin to join the newsletter. And that's how I say hi a lot. There is also, I'd say, Instagram, Kate Courageous on Instagram. And then my coach training is over at teamclcc.com. And of course, The Courage Habit, as I like to say, is available at fine booksellers everywhere.
I will put links to all of that in the show notes. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening and for being part of the Real Talk Radio family. Speaking of the Real Talk Radio family, I wanted to give a huge shout out to Adam Day, my producer and sound engineer. Adam created the music for this show, and he makes everything work and flow and sound way better than I ever could on my own. You can find him and his music, which is awesome, by the way, and his sound editing work at adamday.net. And as I said way back at the top of the episode, this is now and has been for a while a 100% listener-supported show. The show is made possible by awesome people like Erin. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
You ready to answer 5 random rapid-fire questions?
I'm super ready. I've been wondering all day what I'm recently obsessed with, so I'm ready for that.
Because you knew that I was going to ask that, yes. Okay, so that is my first question. What are you totally obsessed with right now?
I've been going back and forth. I've been doing Headspace for, I forget, I have a crazy streak, like 400 and something days, and I feel like that has changed my life in an amazing way. But in a fun way, I'm super obsessed with a couple of the different comics I've been reading lately. So those are my 2 obsessions.
Awesome. A 400 plus day streak of meditation. That's not nothing.
No, but I kind of have like I was doing 10 minutes a day for the first year. And now I'm on the like, they have little cute 3 and 5 minute days, like minute things you can do a day. And I've been totally jiving on the 5 minutes because it's easier.
Yeah, I hear you. I go in and out of the meditation thing. So clearly right now I'm in the out phase of it. So it's nice to hear that it's working for somebody else.
Yeah. I just read Peak Performance and it talked all about how it like changes your prefrontal cortex. And I went to school and was like, kids, you should meditate. It changes your brain. Who knew? But I guess everyone knew except for me. But I just learned. So I was excited about it.
There you go. What feels frustrating for you right now? Like one particular thing or area of your life that you're currently finding challenging?
I think that right now, knowing what to do with my life is challenging. And like figuring out how all the people in my life fit into what I may or may not want to do with my life. But I don't know that anyone ever knows that. But yeah, that is particularly this year. There have been a lot of changes at work, and I just kind of realized that I've been doing things that I don't necessarily love for the past 7 years. So I need to figure out what the heck I want to do.
No big deal. Just small questions, right?
I mean, NBD, right?
Like, NBD, what do I do with my whole life? Shrug. Yeah.
Figure it out. It'll be fine.
I know. I hear a lot of what I'm going through echoed in what you just said. That the way I've been describing it is I feel like 2018 is just like one giant shrug emoji. I'm just like, well, yeah. Shrug. We'll see.
One of my friends says that's the only thing he has on, like, I don't know how you say it, like, auto whatever on your phone. He has, like, a shortcut for the shrug emoji, and I was like, that is what I need.
Yeah, same. Okay, good. Well, now we have homework. What's something that a lot of people seem to care about that you just can't get into, or something that other people seem to prioritize that just isn't really your thing?
This is probably kind of terrible, but the political climate in the world is just so draining for me that I can't keep up with it. Like, it makes me too sad and frustrated. So instead, I try to prioritize the local community that I live in and the people around me. And we, like, talk about it. You know, I interact with the news, but I can't, like, listen to NPR every morning or whatever news on a regular basis. It just sucks my soul. And I feel mildly guilty that I'm not more involved and knowledgeable, but I can't. I just can't.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is your secret weapon in your healthiest relationship? So one of your relationships that works really well, what's something that you do well in it?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm pretty good at honesty in all of my relationships. So I think that that is a thing that I'm good at, like, ranging, you know, from, like, students, and I coach high school athletes and also friends. Like, I'm pretty good at just being like, this is what I need, or this is what I see, or it seems like you're feeling this way. Let's talk it out. So I guess honesty and willingness to have conversation.
Yeah, I love that. And the last question, what's one specific thing that you wish that people were more open and honest about?
Everything. I wish. What do I really? I think what they really need, like, in general. Like, I think that we're really guarded, and that's probably a survival instinct passed down from, you know, whatever, evolution and survival. But I wish that people had an easier time just being like, you know, I'm having a really crappy day, and so if I snap at you, that's why. Or, like, you know, I'm just really sad because I'm remembering this thing and it's not working out for me. Or, like, I'm really excited and I'm overwhelmed and life is great and that's why I'm so bubbly and I can't shut up. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever it is, I just wish people were felt more comfortable verbalizing their immediate needs.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. So you're a member of our Patreon support squad, which means that you're one of the people that listeners can thank for making this podcast possible, since you make a powerful reoccurring pledge that helps to fund the costs of producing the show each season, for which I'm very grateful. And I would love for you to share first why you decided to support the show, and then second, what's been your favorite thing about being in our little community?
Oh, well, my favorite thing is easy first. It's your emails. I love the Friday emails. Those are amazing. And I just want to, like, cut them up and paste them around my life. And be like, okay. Partly, I kind of feel like we're living parallel lives. And I'm always like, she says that so well. If I could just tell other people, that's how I feel too. But a lot of it's just really beautiful. You write really beautifully, and I really like it. And I think fifth or sixth grade, my uncle got me a subscription to Zillions, which was the Consumer Reports magazine for kids in, I don't know, the 90s. And I think that I've always just kind of been aware that, like, money is, like, our money has power, right? So, like, I was vegan when I'm still vegan, but when I was 15, I became vegan because it seemed like a powerful boycott to, like, show people I didn't want to spend my money on something I didn't agree with. And the flip side is totally true. Like, things that I really enjoy, I think it's really important to support with your dollars. And I think you're doing great work and really important stuff. And so I wanted to support you.
Well, that is so well said. And I'm touched by what you said about the Friday emails. They're, like, one of my favorite parts of my work. And it's always so nice. I love when you email me back. I like, love it. I love the whole thing around it. So that feels great to hear that.
It makes me the happiest.
So last question. Will you share, if you're comfortable, where you live and maybe a social media link or something where people could find you if they wanted to reach out?
Yeah, I live in a tiny town in New Hampshire called Jaffrey. And I am Eek Granola on Twitter and Instagram. So Eek Granola, because those are my two nicknames in life. When I was in the Peace Corps, I was the crunchiest person in my group, which is kind of hilarious. You've met me. I'm not the crunchiest person anyone's ever met, but they called me Granola. So that was my nickname.
That's so good. That should be another thing that I ask people is, like, I guess it doesn't work for people whose social media thing is just their name, but I'm always curious, like, how people choose their, like, handles for things. So that's delightful. Yeah. So thank you. And to everyone listening, if you love the podcast, if you want to help keep it going, if you want over 40 hours of bonus content, plus lots of other fun opportunities and extras, just go to patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette to make your pledge of $8 or more for each 8 episode season. Honestly, I can't tell you how much your support means to me, and it'll be so much fun to get to know you better after you've joined our community. Perhaps we can even record a future outro together like this one. That would totally be fun. So until next time, here's a big virtual hug and a reminder that we're all just doing the best we can, and no matter what, we're in this together.